Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller.
That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, I said I like you, like it or not. That's when it got wheels off.
Lauren Groff is a novelist, short story writer, a poet, we find out during the course of this interview. And she's just so brilliant. Oh, man. This is easily one of my favorite Wheels Off interviews I've done. And I've really, as perhaps you might know if you listened, I've really loved all of the interviews I've done for Wheels Off. I feel incredibly lucky to have spent the last 2 years interviewing people for this crazy little thing of mine. But Lauren Groff, man, the way she's able to communicate the intricacies of her process and her sort of philosophical beliefs about the nature of art and the nature of creation, her incredibly useful, detailed thoughts about writing, writing prose, writing poetry. This is a great half hour, and I'm so excited that you get to hear it, and I'm so excited that I get to be a part of it. I'm really grateful to Lauren Groff for joining me. I recommend to anybody read all of her stuff, but specifically her most recent novel, Fates and Furies, which is just incredible. So please welcome to Wheels Off the great Lauren Groff. Welcome to Wheels Off, Lauren Groff. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Wow, this is truly an honor. I'm so excited. For the edification of our listeners, where are you joining us from?
Gainesville, Florida, in the middle of a gloomy day. So I'm happy to be talking to you.
That's so funny. So you wound up in Gainesville, Florida, even though you're a kid from the Northeast, right?
Yeah. It was very much against my will. I did not want to be here, but eventually I came to love it. It's fine. It's great. It's good.
That's so funny.
And you're up in New York right now, yeah?
Yeah, I'm in the Hudson Valley where we've got 2 feet of snow on the ground, and tomorrow they're predicting another 6 inches.
So I miss snow for about 10 minutes, and then I'm so happy not to be around it. I don't envy you right now, for sure.
Yeah, I'm a seventh generation Texan. So growing up in Texas, we had snow twice. And it took me 10 years to even get okay with this.
I hear you. I've been in Florida for 16 years and I'm not okay with the summer, the humidity or anything. So yes, I get it.
So what creative project are you working on right now and how does it light you up?
I'm working on so many. So I tend to work on multiple at any given time. And some of them are very, very rudimentary, or, you know, I'm still just sort of moving my way through them, feeling in the dark. But the one that I'm working on right now is I've got a book coming out in September and then another one next year, hopefully. And it's not a series, it's not a trilogy, but they are three books about women in different periods of time. So the first one's from the 12th century, the second one's from Jamestown in the early 17th century. And this one is a contemporary one. And it's all about women and climate change and the way that religion sort of got us to where we are now and God. And, you know, it's just a lot. It's a lot. They're sort of speaking like whales under the surface. They're not overtly related, but they're very much in the same family.
Oh my God, that sounds fantastic. And I know from hearing you talk about this stuff before that on any given day, you may or may not jump to another project or two that you kind of have running concurrently.
Yeah, no, I have multiple stations up in my little room upstairs that used to be where my second son, it was his nursery. So it sort of has like baby dreams, sort of like jellyfish scooting along the wall. And so it has like a very warm and loving kind of atmosphere to it. But I have multiple areas of this, this couch where I like take my naps and cry. And then I have, you know, like a little stand over there, and I've got this giant long desk I had made as soon as I had my first advance. I got one of my neighbors to make this huge long cherry wood desk. And so I have four or five different stations with four or five different projects on it.
Oh, that's brilliant. So you don't have to change anything. You can just roll your chair to a different spot or move to the couch to work on, like if you're working on the short stories or you have an idea for some random other thing.
Yeah. And I think it's psychological, right? Well, it's definitely psychological, but I think that it's kind of important to be in the space that most speaks to the work at hand, right? So with Fates and Fairies, my last novel, a lot of that I wrote from my bed just because I was so scared of what I was writing that was the one safe space for me to write it from. But a lot of times, you know, I'll write from the downstairs couch because my children are upstairs right now at school all day long, and they are so loud. And it's so annoying. I come all the way downstairs to just sort of escape them. But I think it's really important to get into the right mind space to have a specific place for each project.
It's funny. I spoke with Harlan Coben about this.
I love him. We went to the same college.
Yes. Oh, Amherst.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. He was there. He was suite mates with David Foster Wallace.
I know. How bizarre is that?
I know. He told a great story about one of his first classes where he had to write a paper. He asked David, they were walking back, and he said, "What did you get?" And he said, "I got an A." And he said, "Can I read it?" And he said, after reading his paper, he was like, "Okay, I do not belong at this college."
And that's so wild. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. So, I mean, I'm not going to say I saw similarities between Fates and Furies and David Foster Wallace's work, except in that once I had gotten to the end of it, I had a hard time conceiving of how you could hold all of that in your head. Like, how could you keep all of it straight? And not just like plot stuff, but like the character stuff. And I wonder, I mean, I don't know, there's no question that I can ask you to explain to me how you did that. But I wonder, like, for instance, you said how terrifying it was for you as you were writing it. And I realized that some of our listeners haven't read it, but like, what about that book specifically was terrifying and made you write it from your bed? Was it Mava? Was it the character of this kind of terrifying vindictive mom? Was it the secrets that these people carried around?
Well, I don't think it's giving too much away because it comes halfway through. But the story is told in dual perspectives. The first one from the point of view of a man named Lotto. The second one from the point of view of Mathilde, who is married to Lotto. And Lotto dies halfway through. And I think recently I've been writing into my fears, right? Like, all of my anxiety, my despair, all of my angst in the world, it becomes this great big cloud and I can't see anything but it. And so I try through my work just to look as deeply as possible into this cloud and try to pick out things. And I think one of the fears is, what happens if my husband dies? You know, we've been together since college, you know, we met as undergraduates. He does the taxes, right? I mean, there are other reasons why I don't want him to die, but but it would be horrible, right? Like the person who is kind of been, he's me, but better, if he were to die. So I think that part alone freaked me out. And I wanted, it wasn't cathartic in any way, because I don't think of fiction as actually a cathartic act, but it was an act of trying to make myself braver. But that in turn, it's like, you know, trying to go off of a high dive. If you are afraid of heights, it takes a lot to get up there, to get up the ladder, right? So I think that that's sort of what I was doing with that book in particular.
And maybe the reward when you do challenge yourself to do something that terrifying is that much greater than it would have been if you'd done something easy.
Oh, for sure. No. The easy books, or the books that I think like are easy, are never the ones that actually end up being published. And I have probably 5 to 6 unpublished novels hanging around that I don't think I want, or nobody wants to read them, for sure. No, nobody. Yeah.
This has come up a lot with songs in these interviews, when the idea that you have to write through the bad songs and just get them out, because they at some point they're going to come out. So you might as well just get it over with.
Get it out there. Yeah.
Tougher with novels.
Blocking your energy, right? Mm-hmm. I don't actually know if I believe in all that. I mean, I've had acupuncture before and I liked it. It was nice to be like pinned. But I don't know if it did anything for me, but I do believe that there is creative energy and it can get blocked by the project if you're not like actively trying to look at it or to think about it or to put your hands on it, for sure.
Oh, I just realized that I derailed myself a moment ago. What I was going to say about Harlan was that he had discussed the latest book he had written. And one of the things he said was that, like, he usually writes longhand. Every once in a while, he'll write on a computer. Like, we were doing that discussion that I'm sure everybody wants to know. How do you write your stuff? And I know you write a lot of longhand. But he said that, like, he started taking an Uber to and from his apartment in Manhattan from Jersey and writing in the backseat of a car as he was driving across like the George Washington Bridge. And I love the idea that, like, even just moving to a different spot, like you were describing within your own home, or Michael Chabon talking about, like, he likes to write on his laptop, but a lot of times he'll just go write on his iPad, or sometimes he'll write in a tiny notebook. But it reminds me of Bob Dylan describing when he, and I did not interview him for Wheels Off, when he's stuck on a song, he'll move from guitar to piano to unstick himself. And I wonder sometimes if it's just like mechanical changes like that can sometimes unstick you.
Yeah, right. You have to break yourself. I think the creative process is often a process of breaking the things that you think you know, the things you think you know how to do. Right, the Leonard Cohen line, "The cracks of the way the lights get it," an anthem, or the crack. Oh, I don't know. I don't memorize things. It's true. You do sometimes just need to look at the way that you've been doing things. And if it's not working, then reconsider or work on index cards, for instance. That's one of my tricks too. You know, if I can't, I feel like the big page that I generally love is too intimidating, I'll work on index cards and that'll get me through things too.
Yeah. Not as a way of outlining, but just as a smaller.
Yeah. Piece. A unit. Yeah, it's less bewildering to think about filling up an index card. And then it forces the paragraph that you write to be, it has a lot of energy in it, right? It forces the small space, it acts almost like formal poetry. It forces the words into a form that they wouldn't otherwise take, I think.
God, I love that. It reminds me of something I've heard you say before, which is that you approach your prose like poetry.
Yeah, well, I started as a poet, and I'm not a good poet, but I stole a lot from poetry for, yes. I think that poets have it right in almost every way. They just haven't figured out the way to get paid. In terms of being artists in the world, I think that it's not like they're pure, but they get it, right? Like, a poem is this discrete object that can be worked on continuously until it's done. and a collection of poems is, you know, 100 poems long, and they all interplay. And I think that sometimes when we think of fiction, we think of big slabs of words, as opposed to the way that all of those paragraphs and all those words and all those chapters have to interlate, and the way that they're all sort of in process of taking each other apart, even as they're being built, which is a thing that I think that poets do really, really beautifully, right? So I admire the heck out of poets. I read so much contemporary poetry, and poetry of the past is like my favorite thing. You just steal. You steal as much as possible. I mean, not actual words, right? You don't plagiarize, but you do. You take the way that people work. Yeah.
Homage and inspiration.
Homage and inspiration, or mixing.
And I'm sorry, I don't know if you can hear, my dog is freaking out. Little Ziggy never barks. Okay, good.
No, you've got really good, like a sound system going on. That's
okay.
Really-
so you talk about having started as a poet, and I know that you were, and these aren't your words, they're mine, but I know that you were some version of a world-class athlete.
No, definitely not world-class. My sister is, not me. No.
Didn't you also swim competitively or something?
Dive? Yeah, I swam, I played soccer, I ran, and then in college I did a crew, I rowed.
Okay, but it's your sister that's really...
She's
super
the one.
Outstanding. Yeah. But I guess my question and what I really love to hear about is sort of the genesis of it for you, or where you first realized that you wanted to do something, you wanted to traffic in words, you wanted to be a writer. Was there like an epiphany moment when you were a kid where you just knew this was it?
I'm afraid of people just in general. And I think back when I was a kid, my dog is now freaking out. Back when I was a kid, I would escape from social situations by reading, right? I mean, I think that that is a fairly general thing for a lot of writers. And the one epiphany moment that I can identify was when my friend Lisa Sensession gave me a book of Emily Dickinson's poems, which are so complex and like intense and complicated, but they seem simple on the surface, right? Because she doesn't use, a lot of like large words. She's her imagery is as close to the bone. Her punctuation is eccentric. You feel like as a 12-year-old, you could do that, right? Like, despite the fact that she's an absolute genius, right? So I was copying Emily Dickinson for a long time. And I thought I was a poet, and I got to college, and I couldn't get into any poetry classes for like 3 years. And I finally got into a fiction class. And that was the fiction class was where I feel like my longing and the world itself sort of met there, because I was reading finally contemporary writers, and I was reading not just dead men, which is what my entire schooling up to that point was, because I'm a dual major in English literature and French literature. And so I basically never read past like 1960. And suddenly here's Grace Paley, here's Laurie Moore, right? Here's Alice Munro, here's Toni Kade Bambara, right? All of these amazing, relatively contemporary women. And I thought, oh my God, right? Maybe I can't do it the way that they're doing it, but it's not impossible as a way of life. And after that, I graduated. I was a bartender. My first day as a bartender, there was a double homicide in my bar.
Which
is awesome. Not at all. And it was Philadelphia too, so they didn't even shut down the bar. Just kept going. It gets worse. I was actually in the Tiki Hut with an Eagles cheerleader who was the most beautiful single human I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, she had no pores or anything. She was sort of like the figurehead leaning out into the crowd and then someone died. It was horrible. Oh. And then I eventually went to grad school to be able to devote all of life to this one this one art, one thing that I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Boy, it's funny that you said the word procedure, but because I actually like that as a word for what you do. Well, hearing you describe before your process of like writing a whole thing out longhand and then not looking at it and writing another draft and another draft. And I keep trying to imagine doing that and talk about holding it all inside your head. How closely do those drafts line up? I mean, are they completely different pieces of work?
Absolutely. No, they don't. They bear maybe a family resemblance, but they're not at all. I mean, the characters' names change, right? The form changes, the structure changes, everything changes, the plot changes. And the reason why I do that and I write longhand is because, well, I can't read my own handwriting on purpose, right? I'm trying very, very hard to allow failure into that first draft. And then the next draft, I sort of remember some of the things, but I have a much, much firmer grasp of the fundamentals, right? The foundation of the work, the way that the plot should be. I have even scenes that I've written in the previous one that won't be in this one, but what they do is they give to the next draft sort of a resonance or a feeling as though there's life lived off the page, which is what you want from a novel, I think, short story, right? You want to feel as though the characters have other lives in other rooms, and we're just seeing this one selected short term in their lives, I think. Yeah, I love the process. It took me a really long time to get here, and I wouldn't recommend it for everyone, but I do, and I don't always do it, right? Sometimes with other projects too, I either get it on the first draft or I absolutely need to write it in some other way, right? Either by index cards or on the computer or something else. So it's all about the way that the book itself needs to be written. And I only know that by failing desperately on the first one, intentionally badly.
So you said earlier that you don't believe that writing or the act of creation is, what was the word you used? You said
cathartic.
It wasn't cathartic. Okay. Or, but I wonder, because it has come up so often in these discussions, like how much therapeutic value it has. And I also wonder for you, as you've, gotten to the point where you're at now, like you must have dealt with a number of, and maybe you haven't, maybe you're the one person that hasn't, but you must have dealt with a number of sort of internally generated obstacles, like the voices in our head that tell us we're no good, you know, the anxiety. It's come up a lot about like, I don't know, success guilt or imposter syndrome. And I wonder for you how you've managed to find a way around these things, above them. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, I would love to hear you interview someone who's like, yeah, no, everything's great. I've never had an obstacle. I don't think it's possible. I don't think it's human. Maybe they're just not human. So way back when I first had my first book out, I never thought that I was going to publish anything, to be perfectly honest. I was kind of astonished by the entire process. When art, something that you've held so deeply inside of you for so long, suddenly becomes a product and enters into the world of capitalism, everything changes, right? And it feels gross a little bit. And it feels almost as though you're turning your back on this gift that you're given. It just commerce ruins everything, right? So I had this horrible breakdown. And I have a breakdown every book that comes out. It's just like part of my process. But I had this breakdown until I understood that I had to do something that's probably going to seem pretty weird to some people, but I split myself into two people. And there's one person who's the artist. That's the person who's like the sensitive, like live nerve. And then there's the persona. And the persona is the shell. The persona is the one who gets all the attention, who gets all the criticism, who has to go out into the world and talk about the work, right? But the artist is protected from all that. And just by creating this psychic split, the dualism between this tender nerve and this hard shell has made it feasible for me to actually be an artist in the world, because otherwise it would kill me. And I truly don't think I would be able to survive the publication process.
Wow, this is so great to me. I've never heard anybody put it like that, but I've seen that something like that in action with friends of mine, bandmates of mine, myself. In music, there's a 4-month window between mastering the album and the album's release, during which all of the reviews start to pour in. And it's crushing. And even the anticipation before commerce is evil? Commerce ruins art. Oh my God, that makes me so happy.
What we do is part of the gift economy, right? And if we're lucky, we get paid for it. But that as soon as money enters into everything, everything gets a little bit dirty. And so how do you reconcile the gift economy with the actual economy? And I have not learned how to do it other than to split the soul into two discrete bits.
So I've never heard that phrase, the gift economy. Is that, that's not that what we do is somehow gifted between people. It's that what we do is based on a gift that we were born with or given or something, right?
No, it's been a few years since I've read the book, but there's a book called The Gift by Lewis Hyde, I believe his name is. Mm-hmm. And it's magnificent. It's about creativity, basically. And one of the things that Lewis Hyde talks about in his book is that when you're given something, you need to give it back out into the world, right? It's a continuous cycle. And that's what creativity is, I think, in a very real way. You're taking things in, but you're always having to constantly put it back out into the world. That's what a gift is. And the more that you put things out into the world, the more you get to take in. So you're not being greedy. You're not being, it's like anti-capitalist in a very real sense. There are no artists, real artists, I believe, sitting on hordes of ideas, right? They're not like dragons, like pulling towards themselves all the doubloons and the, you know, the Stanley Cup. instead, right, it's just a constant sense of putting things out there, giving away, blurbing, doing what you're doing right now, which is an act of giving, right? So you're putting a podcast into the world in order to help people through creativity, right? That's a gift. Your music is a gift. So I believe this. But it's horrific to bring everything else back into it. All of the just dirty, capitalism back into the creative economy. At the same time, artists need to be paid. We need to send our kids to school, right? I believe we should all be paid. And so if you have a good way to reconcile all of this, I would love to hear it, but I do not, for sure.
No, and one thing that's come up over and over again in the 2 years that I've been recording these interviews is that when you are in the process of creating something and you are calculating what your audience will want and even worse, what they'll pay for, it ruins the thing you're doing. Like it puts on it the stench of desperation, of calculation. And yeah, it's really hard. I haven't figured it out. Obviously, my profession was gutted like 15 years ago by file sharing and streaming services. I do think there's still something that's sacred about novels that people really believe in. Mm-hmm. God, I wonder about, you know, I think about my friends that write that have been lucky enough to have stuff get optioned. Mm-hmm. I thought about that while reading Fates and Furies, like trying to imagine the movie that it would make.
Yeah, someone today, I was on a phone call with a guy who's like, that is, it's completely unoptionable. Like, it cannot be filmed. Nobody would ever succeed in making it into a movie. And there's part of me that's like, well, there goes my first year of college for my firstborn. And then there's the other part of me that's like, thank God, right? Like, I don't want someone else's vision sort of swallowing up my book. It's very ambivalent.
You know, though, I mean, now we're really off the topic, but I could imagine like an 8-part series, and I could see the way it would work. It's what you talked about earlier. When you The way to succeed in doing in making something that people love is by creating characters that feel real, that they care about and they love. I had a thing happen to me with Fates and Furies where when I got to the end of Lotto's section, I almost didn't want to go on and read Matilda's section because I was like, you know what? I like Lotto so much. I'm on Team Lotto. There's no way this is going to disappoint me. And then, of course, I got to the end of the book and I was on Team Matilda.
So good. I'm so glad. I'm happy that you made that shift.
Well, no, not really. There's no team. I was just so
there's no team.
I was so glad that I, you know, but it's funny because it's that thing. You care so much about these characters. And in the end, that's how something succeeds. Oh my God, I'm so glad. I honestly, right now, I mean, we're not finished quite yet, but this is, I feel like the most useful, maybe even just for me, because my secret dream is to write long form.
I know. I'm so excited to read your novel. I can't, will you let me read it? Can I read it?
You know,
when you're ready.
I recently framed, one of my early heroes was Elmore Leonard.
Yeah.
And I corresponded with him in the mid 90s. Yeah, because his daughter was a fan and I had name dropped him in on a record. And so I wrote him a letter and I sent him a copy of a newspaper article that I'd just written. And he wrote me back and I just framed the letter he wrote me. But it's funny because the little paragraph at the end says, oh, and by the way, I should tell you right now that I don't read manuscripts because if I ever started, I would never have time for anything else. And in any way, it's work. So yeah, the fact that you're offering, I would never take you up on it, but.
Oh no, please do. I mean, I know you have other friends, but like, if I could be an eye, I would love to do that. So,
oh my yeah. God. Okay. Well, vice versa. I'd love to be a reader.
If ever play music. you don't want to hear that.
No, this is great. So you and I both have the thing of an upstairs filled with kids who are doing remote schooling and constantly seemingly in need of our advice, but they never seem to want it. So, yeah. But it does always make me think about what advice I would give them if they wanted it. So I'm wondering what advice you might give a 21-year-old version of Lauren Groff in today's world. What advice you might give her?
It would be advice about gentleness to the self. In order to create anything good, you just have to be kind. You can never talk to yourself in the way that you do, like I do, right? I think understanding that good things come really slowly in the creative life. You need to have patience and persistence and not to give up. I think that some of the most talented writers I have met just stopped writing. And it's the difference between, I think, a published novelist and a non-published one is just attrition, to be totally honest. I think anyone can write a book. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a good book, but maybe the first book is not going, it shouldn't be a good book. Maybe the second one shouldn't be. I mean, I've got tons of thrown away books. It's fine. It's fine to do that because each project that comes out had to come out in order to get you to the project that will be shown in the world. So just be gentle, and to do the thing that I didn't know I did know it at 20. I didn't know it when I first thought I was a writer, which is that artistic practice really is like practice, right? And it's coming out of athletics. If you take 2 weeks off, it's really hard to grow those muscles back. So just touch the work every day. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, write for 3 hours every single day. I know it's really, really hard, particularly with kids everywhere. But if you're just engaging with the work, thinking about it, rereading it, you know, like changing a comma, it doesn't take that long to do. But if you're touching the work will trust you back in sort of a... it's making me sound like a spiritualist, but, and I don't necessarily believe this, but I do believe that the artist and the work exist in a sort of tension. And if the artist maintains and shows fidelity, the art will turn around and show the same thing back. So doing it every day and being patient through the dark times, knowing that everyone has them. Fallow times for fields are good. Fallow times for art is good. These are all important things that I would say to Lauren of 21 years old.
Oh my God, that's so great. But do you ever take breaks? Do you, I mean, I know you just said not to, but then you said fallow times sometimes are good.
So my breaks look like this. So I will go upstairs. I work every day at 5 just because that's when nobody needs me. And I will try to work. And there are times when I absolutely cannot get a single word out on the page. And this is a normal thing for me. So what I do then is I read, because reading is also work, right? Reading is also writing, as long as you're reading intently and with multiple levels, not just pleasure, which I believe in firmly, but also in terms of craft and in terms of what you can take and put into your own toolbox. So there have been years, and not just like a single year, but multiple years, where I have gone up every day, sat down with my notebooks and my pens and cried, and then read for the next however many hours I have.
God.
And that's fine. That's fine.
And you,
essential.
And you survived those.
Yeah, you survived them because eventually the words will come back. And you have to, and you know, it is, I think artistic process is fueled by faith in a certain way, secular faith at least, where you just have to have faith that someday you'll create something that you're proud of and that will light up something in other people. Yeah.
God.
I have to believe this.
Well, I got to say, this has been incredibly inspiring, and I'm so grateful that you sat down with me today. Thank you so much.
I love talking to you again. You're the most generous human being. It's just really lovely and fun. Thank you for having me.
Well, I can't wait for the next book, and go make sure that those kids are okay. I'm going to go do the same thing. And good luck today. I hope the words come.
Oh, thank you. They already have. Thank you. In the morning, 5 a.m. All right. Thank you so much.
Oh my God, 5 a.m. I'm sorry. You said 5. When you said 5, I thought it was 5 p.m.
Oh no. I get it. No.
That's brilliant. Okay, excellent.
It's a nobody needs me. Yeah.
Thank you, Lauren. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.